Welcome to the Men of Eight Gang podcast for Saturday, January 24th, 2009. This is Steve Borsch, and we got a whole gaggle of gang members on, including a new participant on Men of Eight, Gary Kelling. Gary, how you doing?
Good, good. Glad to be with you guys.
Excellent. We'll have you tell a little bit about yourself after we go around the horn. Phil Wilson.
Is it Gary Kelling or Gary Kolling?
Kolling.
Oh, great. No, I screwed it up.
Oh, boy. All right, you can edit it out in post.
Cute. Borsch, did you say Kelling?
I did.
Oh.
I know. I'm sorry, man.
He's going to hang up on us. You pissed him off.
That's right. That's right. And I do see from his LinkedIn profile that he has a fairly tuned bullshit meter. So
I do.
Graham Thickens.
Hello there and welcome, Gary.
Thank you.
Tim Elliott.
Hey, I'm here.
Good. So we're all on. Excellent. Well, let's kick off. Gary, why don't you tell a little bit about yourself? I went out searching for a bio on you this morning and came to your LinkedIn profile, which is just great. So.
Yeah, well, I actually came up through the ad agencies here in Minneapolis. I was most recently at Carmichael Lynch about 5 years ago. And so having spent about 10 years in the ad agency business, you tend to write bios that are a little more,
atypical.
Okay, sure. Atypical. Yeah. And, so I landed at Best Buy about 5 years ago in the ad department. And that was fine, for a while. And then, things started to change, and I think I could see that the ad department there probably didn't have a tremendous amount of future anymore. But that's where I met Steve Bent, the co-founder of Blue Shirt Nation, so we started working on Blue Shirt Nation there, and that kind of led to all kinds of cool opportunities inside Best Buy around the social technology space. So.
Got it. Well, you also ended up right at the very end of your little piece there saying, I used to feel I was better off angry. These days, I guess I'm learning that angry is not enough. And because Phil Wilson's angry all the time.
Yeah.
What's going on, Gary? Can we help?
Yeah. You know, angry was a great, it got me a long ways. Yeah. It really did. The source of it was that, to be honest with you, it was that every time I went along, I felt like I didn't feel very productive. I always felt more productive when I didn't go along, when I was kind of an asshole, when I was, quote unquote, difficult to work with. It always felt like I made more progress that way unbelievable as that may sound, but when I started working in social media more, social technology more, I found out that angry, was still okay, but it wasn't enough. I sort of grew, as a result of working in the social technology space and started to understand that, collaboration, as goofy and as sort of Pollyanna as it sounds, collaboration was probably better. And in fact, it probably couldn't be more true than the story that Steve Bent and I have personally. The fact that if I was left to my own devices, Blue Shirt Nation would have never gotten off the ground, nor would have, any of the other projects that we did, at Best Buy. And so, so collaboration and partnership and some trust, as much as I might hate to admit it, is probably a pretty tight requirement for this space.
Yep. Well, and plus people can call you out in about a nanosecond.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
talk about finely tuned bullshit meter. That's social media overall. So
it's, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and to that end, the reason that you are with us is you responded to something that we put on, because we've all been talking about this for a long time, about making Minovate more participatory and getting more people involved. And we put together this Create for Minovate page, which basically is a forum saying, hey, if you want to participate, here's what we're doing and let us know. And you were interested, and which is terrific.
Yeah. Well, you guys keep bugging me every time I see you.
No, that's Graham. That's Graham.
So what exactly are we going to see some work out of you? Let's go.
Yeah.
No, but it is. It's a great on the Minovate website. It's great. There's a little form that says, "Hey, what do you think? We're out of ideas. Give us some ideas." So I thought, well, what the hell? I'll give you an idea.
Yeah. Great.
So
I'll look forward to that.
What, the idea?
Yeah. Because we're out of them. We got nothing to talk about.
Look, when Borscht starts writing about Mayo, we got to move. We got to make something going on here.
Hey, you be nice to Mayo now. They've been pretty awesome lately.
Yes, they have been.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Graham, you were mentioning that there's something going on with MTS and NVE.
Yeah, in my continual quest to try to find positive news in these times, I was just delighted to see a couple of quarterly reports, financial results of local tech firms, MTS, the testing equipment company in Eden Prairie, and NVE, which is a nanotechnology company locally, just both reported bang-up results. MTS had revenues up 9% for the quarter ending December, and earnings per share growth of 21%. And then I noticed NVE had revenues up 23% in the quarter ending December, and earnings up 45%. So it isn't all bad news here in the local tech community. I think these two companies should be called out for doing so well in tough times. Hopefully we can put their websites into the show notes, Steve.
Yep.
MTS has a really nice looking site, and it's just mts.com. And I would encourage you to take a look at the banner at the bottom, which clicks through to a really cool software demo. It's called their test suite. You can click on that and take a look at a pretty cool flash demo of what they're doing in the software arena. They're a global player in the test equipment business, and been around for 30 or more years here in town. I actually worked for this company early in my career, and our buddy Randy Guise was the art director I worked with there, head of design at MTS, and so he can tell you all about that company as well.
And what does NVE do?
NVE is they're a nanotechnology company, and basically the way they describe themselves is they're a leader in the practical commercialization of spintronics. That's a nanotechnology that relies on electron spin rather than electron charge to acquire, store, and transmit information. So they were kind of a spin-out of Honeywell. The original founder was a PhD technologist from Honeywell. And the company has been, mainly an R&D company, or was for many years, but they've actually succeeded in commercializing their technology. They now produce high-performance spintronic products that include sensors and couplers. And they've also licensed their magnetoresistive random access memory technology, which is commonly known as MRAM. So go to NVE.com. That originally stood for non-volatile electronics, but they just go by NVE Corporation now. And click on the About link and look at the fun facts about their nanotechnology, and that's pretty cool. You might want to put that in the show notes too. So,
well, you know, do you remember Graham, when you and I were at eTech in San Diego, not last year but the year before, you went into one session and I walked into this IBM session where, you know, a guy's like, he's the only guy in a suit and tie in the entire place, and he's up talking about, and he was the guy that was in charge of the new breakthroughs that they'd made in this kind of spin technology. It was a different way of storing data, which obviously was much faster. And that's pretty interesting. Of course, here in Eden Prairie, they're both in Eden Prairie, which, you know, of course is why I'm here. So.
Yep. Tech town, USA here, you know, I mean, we've got a lot of cool stuff going on in this town, and I just, you know, take my hats off to both these companies for rocking and rolling in the hard times here. And, you know, of course, there's no guarantee that things are going to stay rosy for them, but they certainly produce a knockout quarter in both cases.
Yep. Well, hey, this morning I put on a video, Gary, that you had linked to in Twitter, and also I saw from Graham, you did it this morning, like before 6 a.m., and it was Open for Business, Best Buy's Social Technology Strategy. Yeah. Very interesting video, but also, what's the strategy behind doing the video and releasing it like this? Is it just to kind of give a continued heads up in terms of what Best Buy is doing?
Yeah, so actually, the video is coming out at a strategic time. there's a contingent of folks going to a gathering in Munich this coming week called DLD, and I think it's Digital Life and Design. It's a big sort of, it's one of Yossi Vardy's get-togethers, and so it brings together quite a number of people in this space. And Brad Anderson is going to be there, as well as Michelle Azar. And this is the kickoff video to Best Buy's part of the presentation in Munich, which is an event that's leading up to the World Economic Forum in Davos later in the week, I think. So,
okay.
And so I think, it's to me, it's a fascinating look, you know, 3 years on after I got involved in the space, to see so many, and there's only, what, half a dozen people, maybe 8-9 people in the video talking about this stuff.
Right.
But that many people in one organization reading from the same page, basically, is pretty surprising, pretty encouraging.
And those are in leadership positions.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it's not like we all get together and have coffee every day. I mean, we see each other very rarely, but the work that we're doing is sort of all in the same framework, and for that to be happening on a consistent basis, especially at a company that, you know, is as has the kind of short attention span that Best Buy tends to have, it's kind of cool.
I also noticed on Twitter that Remix is getting a lot of play, particularly after that post on Mashable this week.
Yeah, what a great article, huh?
Yeah.
And, you know, and to be honest, you know, Kevin Matheny at Best Buy has been working on, you know, a Best Buy API, you know, or exposing some sort of Best Buy APIs for years now. I mean, I remember talking to him and trying to hatch some plans 2 years ago. And for Best Buy to have open APIs, even though it's just the catalog data right now, for them to be able to expose that data says a lot about the culture, about the willingness to try. They have no idea what's going to happen with it, you know, that, and so I think that's encouraging, and it is getting some play, and I'm really excited to see what ends up getting built out of it.
Yeah, I am as well, and I think as a consumer, just seeing Best Buy, you know, given the kind of environment that you're in right now with the, you know, your biggest competitor, Circuit City, calling it quits and so forth, that continuing that innovation is really something that is impressive.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's we're going to find out more and more that, and it makes for great headlines, but I think things have changed. I don't think it's just rhetoric or a splashy headline. I think the environment that we're in has begun to change fundamentally, and I don't think, you know, the old ways of doing things are gonna cut it anymore. I mean, being a destination instead of being a participant. It's not going to cut it anymore. I think, you know, you have to be able to go where people are. And we see that replayed, you know, on different levels over and over and over again, whether it's internal social networking or, whether it's, web apps showing up on mobile phones or whatever it is. I think if you have stories that you want to bring to the conversation, you have to go where the conversation is. And for Best Buy, the Remix open APIs, I think are the best move we've made toward being able to do that so far.
Yeah, I don't want to make this the Best Buy podcast, but one thing that occurred to me is that, you know, an application could be developed on an iPhone or a T-Mobile G1 kind of platform, the Android platform, where while you're in the store, based on a profile, you could be messaged about things you might be interested in. And there could be this interesting interplay between the online world and the physical world inside the store, which I think that every retailer is going to have to deal with, because a lot of consumers are, you know, you get hands-on in the store, you find the best price online, and you buy wherever the best price is these days.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think this, you know, whether it's Best Buy or whether it's Amazon or Target or Walmart or whoever it is that has to address these issues, I think they're going to find out that not only do they have to try some things, but they're also going to find out, I think, that when they do try some things, they're going to end up in places where they never expected. Maybe not, and, you know, places maybe that they didn't necessarily want to end up, you know. I mean, you know, the idea of being able to compare products across retailers when you're standing, you know, in one particular store, that's that's not exactly the dream of every merchant, you know.
I can imagine it's a nightmare.
it is the nightmare, if we don't build these things and be part of the conversation. As retailers or as manufacturers or as, whatever role it is that you're playing in the economy, if we're not participating, if we're not helping to build these things, someone else will, and it'll get built to their specs instead of yours.
Right, right. I think that the web is becoming, you know, a large part of the culture. And, you know, Best Buy acknowledging that and trying to reach out to the community and, you know, to try to engage that community is great. And kind of segueing into another topic, I think Steve and I found the link on Forbes for the most wired broadband cities in the U.S. And I was very heartened to see Minneapolis number 7.
Nice.
Well, I wonder if I tried to dig into that a little bit, and it's got to be because of the wireless footprint.
Not really. If you look at the factors, I think in the thing in the piece that they called out was more the diversity of choices.
Oh.
And that was really along with Wi-Fi hotspots. But I think the choices is what they put in the piece to say, hey, you know, there's in some cases, there's over 20 providers of internet service, of broadband internet service in these neighborhoods in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
What the heck is with that? I mean, where are they getting 20? I don't, you know, that struck me as weird. I'd not heard that before.
Well, I tell you, when I'm downtown sometimes and open up my, you know, my Wi-Fi and try to find a link, there is a list a mile long that pops up. So, yeah, there's a lot of providers out there.
But it's not only Wi-Fi. It's you know, EVDO
and other
cellular kinds of things. And then you've got a number of cable providers and, you know, and telco like Quest out there that are also in that market. So, you know. I think that bodes well for the Twin Cities market, which, you know, hopefully will spread to the rest of the state.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if that sort of standing gets us a little higher up on the list as a potential WiMAX market, because that would be very exciting from my standpoint. So.
Absolutely.
Right. When those numbers start coming out, we'll be moving down the list. Like the Forbes article says, you know, they don't have the WiMAX data in there yet for Baltimore and Portland. So they'll be moving up the list when that data gets in there.
Yeah, but maybe by this time next year, we'll be seen nationally as more of a tech kind of center, given the broadband penetration.
I've always kind of felt that Minneapolis is recognized, at least by a lot of insiders, as being very much tech savvy, very much internet savvy. You know, Gary, you've been spending a lot of time in the national front these days, traveling around and talking about all sorts of different things. What is the perception of Minneapolis beyond the stereotyped flyover country?
Yeah, well, it's, God, that's such a difficult thing to pull apart. I mean, I think a lot of these conferences that we go to on the coasts, we're known as the home of Best Buy and Target, right? Mm-hmm. That's what people know us for. And
that in cold weather, yeah.
Yeah, right. I remember, you know.
And ice fishing.
Right. I've been in San Diego in the summer and they go, oh, you're from Minnesota. Is it really cold up there? And I'm like, right now, you mean? It's good. Yeah. Yeah. Is it cold right now? Oh, my God. But I think when you get into talking to folks who do pay more attention, you know, you're obviously you're talking about healthcare and you're talking about medical devices. I think it's generally regarded that we're probably, you know, among the more overeducated metropolitan areas in the country. I mean, you know, if you compare us to, say, you don't hear a lot of buzz about Houston or Atlanta or, Salt Lake City necessarily. I think the general perception is that we kind of know what we're doing.
Overeducated, even with Borsch?
Well, he brings the average down a little bit.
I was going to say, he's going to bring the curve down, isn't he?
He's just one guy.
Just remember, I can pull the plug in a heartbeat, just so you guys know. Yeah, bunch of kidders.
I was going to say, Steve, there are some things that are putting us on the map lately. I mean, we were one of the first areas active in the social media breakfast movement, and
that's right.
You know, I think one, you know, with some of our groups, our social media and otherwise, our mini demo and mini bar, the bar camp phenomenon, we, you know, people in our industry know that we're ahead of a lot of other cities in regard to things like that.
Yeah, and I think in academic circles as well. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, Stanford and Carnegie Mellon and you know, places like that are clear standouts. But the University of Minnesota Computer Science Group is, I mean, we're no slouch here. You know, people recognize that we turn out some pretty bright folks here.
Oh yeah, and the Carlson Entrepreneurship Program is very highly regarded, as is Carlson overall.
Yeah.
So we got some cool things happening on the West Bank and the East Bank both, and we're becoming more known for that, I think.
Well, speaking of becoming known, Paul DeBettings did a post about Mayo and General Mills making Fortune's 100 Best Companies to Work For list. Mayo was number 24 and General Mills number 39. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And of course, that dovetails into the post that I did do about Mayo, about them coming out with a new presence, a new Sharing Mayo Clinic blog. And it was pretty interesting to kind of dive into that and talk to the guy that's in charge of it and so forth. So there's more and more things happening that people are in leadership positions are recognizing that time is a wasting and having really profound online presence is really important.
Does anybody find it odd that Mayo doesn't offer 100% health care? Does anybody find that odd?
Don't they?
Is that true?
No. Yeah. I was kind of cruising through the stats on each city and, I don't think anybody offers 100% health care, but I thought, wow, Mayo Clinic, I bet you their health care probably, oh, I guess not. So I thought it was interesting.
Interesting. Huh. Well, here's another topic. Speaking of that is the social media breakfast, which is going to be next Friday at 8:00. It's going to be at the Minneapolis Central Library on 300 Nicollet Mall.
Hosted by the lovely and talented Meg Canada.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, yes. Meg is the one that gets us the space at the library.
So. Oh, I did not know that.
Yep.
Okay. And then Paul DeBettings is going to, it's going to be about social media and job hunting, those sorts of things. So that should be pretty interesting.
And yeah, make sure you bring your own bagel or donut or whatever.
Yeah.
There's nothing will be provided.
Nothing will be provided, it appears,
well,
at this point.
That may change. I hear there are some sponsors stepping up. We're finding that more and more companies are getting wise to the advantages of sponsoring these social media breakfasts. So Rick Mond told me that he had a couple that were looking like they were going to step up to pick up the breakfast goodies.
Well, that's encouraging.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, I got to throw this out because this has kind of been scratching, or it's an itch that I've got to scratch and just talk about. For some reason, over the last, I'd say roughly 2 weeks, I've been contacted by people who I haven't heard from for some time or heard from peripherally, who in essence are scrambling for business or looking for business. And they're, you know, developers and coders and, in one case, independent consultant. And they're now, they've always been seeing nice steady growth in web asset development and application development. And then, when the iPhone came out, iPhone development and so forth, but that nice steady growth has stopped and they're now finding themselves, in a position to market and sell. So the more I've been thinking about that, over the last couple of weeks, and here I get maybe this is the question for discussion. Is this more an issue of them responding to the needs that a client sees or positioning themselves as solution centric and moving forward with a specific solution? So rather than respond to RFPs and RFQs and go out and pitch your services to be able to develop, instead go to the clients or the prospects with a solution or a set of solutions or possibilities that they're not exploring.
There may be some of that, but I think it's a more fundamental kind of a thing where some people just need more work. So it's a supply and demand deal given the economy, but Others may just be taking advantage of the downturn to try to build their client base. You know, so they're looking, they're seeing the times as a
opportunity,
real opportunity to get new biz. So I think you're seeing that probably more than you're seeing some fundamental shift in, you know, marketing strategy.
Well, I was talking to somebody the other day. Honestly, I don't remember who. I think it was somebody in New York about just the general overall feeling of web and interactive business. And you know, he made sort of an offhanded comment, though I don't think necessarily real seriously. But he says, you know, kind of feels a little 2001-ish right now, implying that you know that bubble burst. And I think that's probably just sort of an outgrowth of frustration of really turning a lot of the stuff that we have out there into a business model. You know, I think social media comes to mind, obviously, if you take a look at a lot of the online music services and online video services. It's you know, okay, so really, how do we make money on this? No, really, how do we make money on this?
Yeah, and I think so I was at Blogwell in Chicago a couple of days ago, and there didn't seem to be from the folks who were speaking and the folks who were there who were interested, didn't seem to be any decline in interest or any decline in the planning of using this kind of stuff, you know, in the next year to 18 months. But Steve, I've gotten a lot of similar calls too, saying, hey, what do you got? What do you got? I've got something that I'm trying to do here. And, part of me thinks that it's timing, right? The collapse, the economic collapse, the timing, you know, in the last part of the year like this, has given everyone pause. It's like we just hit the iceberg. Now everyone's holding onto a railing to see which side of the boat's going to sink first.
Right.
You know, and there's planning going on and there's budget allocations happening, but it's all behind closed doors. Everyone's just sort of waiting to see, you know, where the bottom is here first before we start spending it. So I think that lull has given a lot of these folks on the outside this sort of wake up to, oh my God, I got to get in there, and I've got to make myself. It's the contracts aren't just being handed out anymore. They're under wraps, and they're, you know, I think a lot more strategic and yeah, how do we make money on this stuff? So,
well, and you know, the other thing that I've been finding, and this has been just bizarre, but, I've been doing several different things that people in my network are aware of, and business has been coming to me recently that is stuff that I normally would never go after. And I've just sort of backed into it where I've gotten a call from a buddy of mine out in Marin who said, hey, my client needs X and I know you do it. Would you be able to do it for him? And if so, what would you charge? And so we got into a little bit and we started to talk about it. And he said, no, that's too cheap. And I'm thinking, okay, well, actually, like, I think this is a nice piece of business. And so things have just sort of appeared. And here's why.
Too cheap.
Yeah, I know. But well, because he's going to pass it through. He's not going to mark it up. So he's, you know, he's trying to help me out, which sure. I've helped sure. him out a bunch on all kinds of stuff. But here's the point. The point is all of his clients are looking for better, cheaper, more efficient ways of doing things that they've either always done or that they know are possible and they want to do. So rather than go to, you know, some agency and have something produced for them, they're going to look for another alternative and still get the outcome that they want, still get the quality and the you know, the output and so forth. But that, I think, you know, that's overall, that's the biggest key, is that people are open to looking at things that they would normally not have looked at because of the economic times.
Yeah. Doesn't that sound like a recipe for absolute success for social technology?
Yeah.
What's the simplest, cheapest, fastest thing we can do? I mean, the tools are, they don't get much faster, cheaper, or simpler, to experiment and to try to get the outcomes that you're looking for. You know, I was talking to a guy yesterday, internally at Best Buy, who's working in a separate department. He was, you know, he asked me to come down and take a look at something that he had gotten from an agency. And he said, I really like the thinking at the front of the deck, the strategy, the proposed outcomes. But when we get to the backside of the deck, it looks too expensive. He's like, I want what the front half of the deck is saying, but I don't want to commit to what the back half of the deck is proposing. And I think, in a way, I think that's an interesting conundrum, interesting meaning horrible, conundrum for agencies in general. If they have some kind of line on how to do this stuff, they're in a spot where they can't show decks that promise iteration and promise, you know, flexibility. They have to show the whole enchilada. I mean, that's the agency model, right?
Right.
And that's a, geez, I would hate to be having to pitch business as an agency right now, where you can't walk in and say, we're not exactly sure what's going to happen, but we'd like to try some things. I mean, how do you make money doing that?
Right, right, right. Well, the answer is you don't. Unless the client is, you know, of a mindset where they're willing to take some risks, they're willing to try some things. Because, you know, you've said it many, many times, Gary, is the culture of Best Buy is what allowed Blue Shirt Nation to happen. And you weren't sure that, and you've said publicly, I don't think this could happen everywhere or maybe anywhere else, that the company was open to risk, was open to you know, trying something differently, to risk failing and so forth. And you know, I watched what we were at what social media breakfast event where the guys from Fallon got up and talked about what they'd done for the sci-fi show Eureka.
Yeah, we met a deluxe.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And how it was sort of an experiment and they were trying it and all of that. And I just sat there and laughed because my 14-year-old son and I love Eureka, and he was the one who, you know, sat bolt upright in his chair and goes, Dad, look, Sarah has a Twitter account. Sarah is the computer behind the house that the sheriff lives in. I know you got to watch the show to know what I'm talking about, but these guys had pitched Universal on doing this and just taking a risk, just trying it. Let's see what happens. Let's see how many people we can get to follow Sarah and so forth. And it was that openness, that willingness to take a chance. And not go in and say, you know, here's this completely new thing. We have no idea what's going to happen, but here's the ROI. So to your point, you know, you can't lay the whole thing out because all the processes are shifting. The methodologies are shifting. The ability to get people's attention is shifting. Yeah. And there isn't any tried and true best practice for the most part.
Well, you know, there's a corollary here, right? Where, you know, there's the guy, there's the barfly who says, I've got all these pickup lines that are guaranteed to work for you, right? Which is complete crap. There is no slam dunk method every time that works, right? And why? Because people don't respond to that kind of thing. You can't just walk up to somebody and expect to have a deep, meaningful relationship with them right off the bat. You have to get to know them. Companies are forced with having to do the same thing, you know, and coming out of 50, 60, 70 years of not really caring what the relationship was, just really caring about how many people heard your message. This is new. And culturally, this is going to take companies a while to get comfortable with the concept that, you know, using social technology means having some patience, trying some things, building actual real relationships, you know, much the same way that you'd have to build them with individuals.
Well, you know, I talked about this some time ago, but my wife was a buyer at Target. She in audio when I met her. I was a rep calling on her years ago, and then she got promoted before I asked her out, by the way, so there was no conflict of interest. But
yeah, right.
I knew you'd chime in, Phil, and go, yeah, she's been regretting it ever since.
Look, but, she's far too hot for you. I don't know really why.
thanks, pal. I like you too. So at any rate, one of the guys that she got to know was Ron Johnson, the guy that's now the SVP of the Apple retail stores. And we happened to be in the Southdale store one day, and he's in there, and we start chatting. This is right when the stores, at that point, they had maybe 50 stores. And he was asking me, you know, about my thoughts about how, you know, what I thought about the store, because I'd been around for so long and had worked for Apple and so forth. And one of the things that I talked about was how it sort of bugged me that Apple didn't know who I was, you know, that I'd been this user and I was responsible for all these machines and I was an influencer with the Mac and so on and so forth. And asked him about how come you guys don't have a CRM system that you use? Because when you send stuff out, you blast it out to everybody. The response, not to quote him, but in a nutshell, was if we were to jump into personalization, and now when an extension of that, of course, conversational marketing with social media, is it doesn't scale. When you have, you know, 25, 50, 75, or 100 million people who are fans of your company and your product and all of that, you can't engage with all of them or even 10% of them because it doesn't scale.
Yeah, that's such an old school mindset, isn't it?
Well, it is, but I mean, it's that's kind of where executives come from, is that okay, so if we're going to engage, if we're going to get into this in a big way, you know, do we have to hire hundreds of community managers or you know, how do we go about you know, what's the process, what's the method to make sure that, you know, if people are replying to us, that we're not ignoring them.
Yeah. you don't have to be responsible for answering every single question. And you're going to have to let go of that, that concept, because you've never been responsible for answering every single question. When I have a question about Apple, who's the first person I ask? The guy sitting next to me who's also using an Apple.
Yeah.
Right? And that's always the way it has been. You know, it has never been that when I have a question about Apple, I call Apple. It's never been that way. And so the idea that you know, any company thinks of themselves as the center of the universe, it is ludicrous, right? And culturally, you have to get past that idea that your resources are the only resources available, right? I mean, you know, the most valuable things we know, and the most important things that we the things that we prize most in, you know, in life in general are open and social by nature. They're built by all of us, you know, whether it's our history or our culture or Wikipedia, you know,
right.
These are things that global resources come to bear on, and global resources, If your company can tap into global resources, your users, your customers, your friends of friends, your employees, you know, you'll be able to support and distribute your brand, your products, your culture. It does scale. It does scale. You just have to change where you're looking for resources.
Well, okay.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, to that end, under Gil Amelio, Apple had, remember they were staffing up that you could call the 800 number if you had any problems with your Apple. And they ended up hiring hundreds of people down in Austin, Texas to field a call center to be able to run that. And when Jobs came back in 96, he basically laid everybody off and went to Jive Software and implemented their threaded discussion forum and basically offloaded all of that to the discussion forum. And I know this is a sweeping generalization, but what was funny was even I shifted at that point, and I began to look first for my answers within the community, and then secondly, on the web, you know, as that was just starting, there were, you know, Mac Fix It, and there were some other forums or some other sites, but that's where I turned to first. And now I pride myself on the fact that I almost never call tech support, ever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the shift that occurred was sort of this offloading to the world, offloading to the community, which is where it should have been anyway. Because you can't, a company doesn't know everything and they can't staff up. And most importantly, just about everything, every issue that I have with WordPress or with Drupal or when I was doing Joomla stuff, with Apple, with Windows, with anything, the very first place that I turn is the web. And I can almost, somebody else has had the same problem.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one thing Apple doesn't lack for is friends, right? People are rabid about Apple. And you can pull apart why that is. But the fact, you know, it's not entirely important to the conversation. Everyone has their own way of making friends. Apple clearly has no shortage of friends. And when you have friends, they help you, you know, it's, you know, I mean, on an interpersonal level, it's the thing that we prize most is a friend, right? Someone you can call when your car dies, someone you can call when you have a question about this, that, or the other thing, you know? So building friends, as a company, I think it's an objective people need to take seriously, and there's no greater time to date than now to take advantage of the social tools that are out there to actually make friends. It's just a matter of whether your culture really wants to be friends with your customers.
Yeah, I think it does scale, and it scales the same way that call centers scale. And you know, Steve's point was one I was going to make, which is you could also, you know, open source it to the community with forums and such. So I the whole scaling argument, I really don't agree with. It's just another tool.
Yeah. You know? All right. So let me ask you this, because this is something else that's sort of been percolating in my brain for quite a while. And I've been in the Eden Prairie Best Buy store 3 different times, just, you know, buying whatever, and walk over to the camcorders because I'm waiting for the Flip Minnow HD to appear. I don't know if you guys follow Robert Scoble. I mostly don't pay attention, but he's shot some videos with the Flip Minnow HD, and is going to be doing a comparison with the Creative and the Kodak piece. But the stuff that he's been putting out is pretty doggone good. I mean, I'm really surprised. But so here's where I wanted to go with this. I've been thinking about the online or social media Osborne effect. So when Adam Osborne had his portable company and he pre-announced his next generation, and it was, what, 6 or 8 months before he shipped, and the sales of his existing product just stopped and it put him out of business. He didn't have any cash flow. And I've been thinking about that a lot, in that when you have Engadget and Gizmodo and you've got all this CES coverage and everybody knows what the next generation is and when it's coming, you know, is that, especially for retailers, is that creating an online Osborne effect?
I don't think so, because, you know, the product cycles are so fast now, and there's so many manufacturers vying for the same categories that you're always seeing innovation. You're always seeing new products coming out, you know, every quarter. So I think it's, you know, for a single company, maybe there's some things to worry about. But from a consumer standpoint, I think there's plenty of diversity and plenty of choices. And we're just seeing things happen all the time. So, Steve, if you really want a point and shoot HD camcorder, you can go out and buy one today. It may not be Flip's, it may be somebody else's, but it's available.
Yeah, but if it's extraordinarily easy to see that, you know, the current one has these features and the next one has 3 features that I really want. And because the awareness is so simple to obtain, you know, the information is just there, because these are places I'm going and sites I'm following. What the result is you don't go in and buy something that's on the shelf. And in the words of an old sales mentor of mine, a sales manager that I had when I was first starting out, I would always be interested in what was next. And he would slap me upside the head all the time and say, sell what you can ship. And that was his mantra. Sell what you can ship. Sell what you can, you know, sell what's on the shelf. Don't sell futures. Because if you sell futures, you're gonna basically not make any money and put yourself out of business. And so that's kind of where I was going with it is, you know, I know that we are atypical in terms of our level of awareness, but everybody's awareness is growing and it's getting easier and easier to know in any given category what the next thing is, you know, who's announced something. And so why not just wait?
It almost seems like not an option anymore. You know, maybe you do take a hit on cash flow. I don't know, but it just doesn't seem like it's an option to wait anymore or to, you know, to hold back news. I mean,
Well, it reminds me of a blog post I saw yesterday or the day before, which is, you know, commenting on Apple's results over the holiday and how strong iPod sales were, which is, you know, surprising given that, you know, everyone has at least one or two iPods that I know.
Yeah.
Right. I have like three of them. Right. So, you know, I think this is Arrington at TechCrunch, I believe, but the author was saying, Apple gets it because they make it very simple. They don't have 42 different permutations of the same platform. Like if you're shopping for GPS these days, you see that Garmin has like five models, which are basically the same thing with different software bits turned on and off at different price points. That just confuses customers. So they were saying, you know, if Apple got into the GPS business, they would have one GPS. They wouldn't have, you know, three or four different versions.
Yep.
And that's the same thing that they do with the iPod. They have, you know, different versions of iPod, but they're so dramatically different from each other that they can appeal to different market segments.
You know, maybe that's the modularity of the web, you know, about the remix and the mashup and the you know, creating composite applications in a dashboard with NetVibes. And, you know, maybe that's where this is all going, is it's all going, you know, modular in a way that doesn't make it a necessity to try to bake everything in. You know, the old joke about Microsoft Word is that there's every possible feature any human could ever want. And as a consequence, the learning curve to really take advantage of it is just so doggone high. And then stuff happens in there that you can't figure out how to fix. And then, you know, Apple comes out with Pages and gets slammed because it has so few features. Well, the newest iteration of it has that full screen view where you can click that. And the only thing that's in front of you is a, you know, electronic piece of paper that you can type on. So to get rid of all the visual noise, get rid of all the distraction. And so maybe that's what it is. It's the focusing on the core and focusing on the essence, because others are going to do it all. I mean, you know, it's kind of WordPress and plugins. It's Drupal and modules. It's the fact that, you know, focus on the core. Don't try to do everything, because if you set it up as a platform almost, then you know, people are going to accessorize it for you.
Yeah, we're seeing that with software. I mean, I used to use Photoshop for everything relating to images, and I probably haven't used Photoshop three times in the past 6 months, because 90% of what I do, I can do with Acorn, and then the other 10% I can do with Pixelmator, which are, you know, two really inexpensive Mac applications that give you just what you need to get the job done, as opposed to the Swiss Army knife, which is the Photoshop.
Yeah, I think too, if you look at, I mean, the proliferation of apps that are out there, they're so dead simple anymore. I mean, there's very few, you know, web apps that are coming out that try to be, you know, more than one thing, you know. And so I do think that it's, you know, we're headed to a place where it's like, no, this is what I want, and I'll turn this bit on, this bit off, and you can charge me for what I walk away with. Well, you see it sort of with folks like Basecamp too. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion lately about software as a service and how do you price it and that sort of thing. And I think Basecamp, you know, the guys at 37 Signals are interesting in that, basically what they're doing is they're charging for features, right? You get the basic for free, you know, and if you want to step up, you basically pay for more features.
Well, and I wish I could remember who said this, but it was at a Web 2.0 expo. I was sitting and listening to a panel, and I remember Chris Messina was on the panel, and Emily Chang and somebody else. There were like four people. At any rate, the discussion that came up was about modularity, extensibility, and all of that. And the biggest aha that came out of this whole thing for me was that there has to be a path for power users. So once somebody figures it out and they learn how to use it, their needs are going to grow over time. And if you don't address the growth of those needs, they're going to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And that's the paradox right now is how do you make it simple, but how do you make it extensible so it can meet the needs as people become more experienced and become more knowledgeable.
Yeah. You're seeing two different phenomena sort of starting to collide. You've got the big box phenomena, you know, which is we're going to put everything in here and that's our business model, right? More is better. And then you have, what you're seeing with software and on the web, which is pick what you want. And I think the folks that are following the pick what you want method are in a much better position to continue a relationship with a power user and at the same time be able to bring in folks who are just getting started. Whereas a big box mentality is, well, I mean, you know, we've been making, you know, collectively, we've been making fun of the big box mentality for many, many years. I think it comes back to question of culture. Are big box brands, big box companies, big box manufacturers for that matter, which, you know, you could include, Detroit in that, you know, they use much the same approach.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have the culture that's going to allow them to evolve, into this new, way of wanting to interact with products, which is just the way I want to interact with them, not the way everyone like me, 25 to 34, white suburban male, it's going to be interesting to see if the big box cultures can evolve or if they're going to, or what's going to happen to them.
No. Well, gentlemen, we are bumping up against our end time here, and I wanted to just kind of toss it out and we can maybe just mention some upcoming events and things that are happening. So what's going on coming up besides the social media breakfast next Friday?
Mini demo coming up.
Yep. And that's what date?
February 6th.
Yep.
On Summit comes up in March on the 7th.
Okay.
Yep. And before that, we have a tentative date for a February social media breakfast, and it's going to be a South by Southwest free meetup, which is going to be pretty fun. Hopefully we'll see some of the details coming out on that, but Rick Mon and I have been putting that together with a couple of young ladies by the name of Jennifer Kane and Carrie Delaria, who are the brains and brawn behind MEMA Summit. They run that, and they're going to South by Southwest this year. So they want to do a pre-meetup, and should be some fun things going on at that. Tentatively, February 20th, I guess it is, a Friday.
Fabulous. I'm going to be traveling to Phoenix, I believe the 23rd and 24th, for the ETAIL get together. I'm going to be on a panel with Steve Bent. And then beginning of March, I think March through the 3rd, 1st through the 3rd, Steve and I are also going to be at a Computer World event where we're doing a, it was so funny because Computer World called us and it's this IT Premier 100, you know, and you've got lots of VPs and EVPs and directors of IT. And I wrote back and I said, I don't think we are who you think we are.
Yeah.
I don't think we belong in your in your conference. And so I turned her down and she wrote back. She's like, no. You know, we want someone to come in and you know, talk about it from the other side. And so we're doing a we're doing a session called Fight Club, how to use open social how to use social technology to piss people off and get things done. So
great title.
That should be fun.
Cool. And I'll be at demo those same dates, March 1st through 3rd in Palm Desert. Lucky me.
Excellent.
And I'll be heading down for some breakfast a little bit later on this afternoon, if you're this morning, if you'd like to join me.
All right. You bunch of kidders. Hey, thanks for being on. Hey, Gary, thanks for stepping up and jumping in to Create from Innovate, and glad to have you on the podcast.
It's a pleasure, and I hope you guys invite me back.
Oh, absolutely.
Every chance.
All right. Well, have a great weekend, everybody.
Thanks. You too.
Goodbye.
All righty. Take care.
Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.